back of a police van. You were taken out of the city jail, you know, held overnight. They were just trying to clear the corners because they had lost the framework for actual police work. They didn't know how to actually solve crimes anymore, but they did know how to fill the wagons. You would go downtown to the city jail, and they'd ask you to sign a form saying, I won't sue. If I don't sue, we'll let you go now if you sign the form. But if you don't sign the form, we're keeping you for longer until you see a court commissioner.
So your sense of him running for president? We have 5 seconds.
Well, listen, he's done some things I admire, gay rights and ending the death penalty. But, you know, the notion that he reduced crime by doing that is just a lie.
David Simon, I want to thank you for spending this time. Journalist, television writer, best known for creating the HBO series The Wire and Treme. Now his latest project, Show Me a Hero, on HBO. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website's democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News, so stay tuned for that.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Featuring
Serena Fong,
Joshua Harper,
Sarika Mehta,
Mevin Tenenbaum,
Nia Lewis,
Brian Pritchett,
Jen Chavez,
Robert Barncord,
Linda Olson-Osterlund,
Liam Delta,
Crystal Leedy,
Miles Bryan,
Mamie Stevenson,
Ben Renner,
Dan Johnson,
Ross Freeman-Levin,
Joe Meyer.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, local Shell No protester Jonah Majur had his day in court today.
Israel bans asylum seekers from Tel Aviv.
And the U.S. military is lifting a ban on transgendered soldiers. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 26th, 2015. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
A protester who was arrested during the Shell No protests earlier this month trying to stop Shell's icebreaker from returning to the Arctic had his day in court today. Jonah Majur received 8 hours of community service for locking himself down to a railroad bridge to try to stop the icebreaker from leaving port. His action followed 2 days of kayak blockades and a half dozen activists dangling from the St. John's Bridge to block the ship. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg was at the courthouse this morning and spoke with Jonah about his direct action.
Just on the issue of Charlie Hales, he came to a totem pole ceremony 2 nights ago about fossil fuel extraction in the Pacific Northwest and talked about how he is in opposition to it. What do you think Charlie Hales needs to do in order to put that rhetoric into action?
He needs to take action. He's very good with everything he does about talking himself up and his platform up when really he doesn't actually take action. So here in Portland we have ARC Logistics, a very large oil by rail terminal that is accepting crude oil from North Dakota as well as the tar sands, both of which are known to explode as well. And he has done nothing about it and hasn't even made a statement on it. So maybe he should at least make a statement on ARC Logistics if he wants to even pretend that he's serious about banning fossil fuel export in our city.
Well, and ARC Logistics, it's interesting, the background of that they never really went through a public process in order to bring that terminal into Oregon. Do you know a bit about that history?
Yeah, totally. ARC Logistics was operating as an asphalt plant. It used to be an asphalt refinery, although there was a lot of asbestos in the refining process that was getting released. So then... After a while, they shut down under the name of McCall Oil and Chemical, are still masquerading as McCall Oil and Chemical, but are in fact ARC Logistics. And back in February 2013, I believe, or 2014, not really sure which year, They reopened without any public process. This was under Charlie Hales's watch, and haven't even sought a new air quality permit yet, and are operating under an expired permit. So seems like a pretty lousy aspect of public process.
And I understand they're also bringing in more volume than they're allowed to?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we see this happen. You know, another example of that happening was in Klatskanai at Port Westwards. They were bringing in six times as much volume as they were allowed to. The DEQ fined them something like $100,000. When you equate that to how much money that company makes in a year, that's the equivalent of taking like 30 cents out of URI's paycheck in a year. So the fine was already nothing, but then the DEQ went ahead and approved that expansion, that sixfold expansion of volume, as well as eventually dropping the fine in the first place. So, and that terminal was built with $30 million in green energy subsidies to be a bioethanol plant and operated for maybe 2 months and then shut down and reopened as a crude oil terminal.
And so when you took action as part of the Shell No protests, was that something you were planning on, or did you see that the ship was going to be underway and decided at the last minute that you had to take action and lock yourself to the railroad bridge?
It was a mix of both.
And why did you decide to take direct action as opposed to maybe just standing on the sidelines and holding a sign?
Because unfortunately holding a sign does not get as much media coverage as we're finding, so and doesn't actually physically stop the Fenneca, which was my goal, which I got to do for an hour at least.
And what's the status of the Fenneca now?
The Fenneca is in the Arctic now, and Obama gave the final approval for them to start drilling for oil in the Arctic.
Are there other rigs that may be coming to Portland or Seattle for this operation that could be a potential for a future protest?
Yeah, I'm sure in Portland and Seattle we'll see Shell's fleet come back again. And Vigor Industrial has said that they look forward to the Fenneca's initial presence in Portland as a way to expand their future efforts in supporting offshore oil drilling in the Arctic and elsewhere.
The Fenneca broke its hull. How difficult is that to do?
I mean, it took a lot of recklessness on the part of the captain, and yeah, it's an icebreaker, and it just happened to run up against a rocky embankment, and we're looking forward to more of that happening and maybe totaling the Fenneca in the future, but
that's up to the crew itself, I guess.
Yeah, we put our faith in the captain to make sure that the Fenneca will be out of commission.
All right, thanks, Jonah, and good luck today.
Yeah, thank you.
This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO Radio outside of the courthouse this morning here on 4th Avenue in Portland.
The Permanent Court of Arbitration has ruled that Russia must pay unspecified compensation to Greenpeace in connection with the seizure of the ship, the Rainbow Warrior, in 2013. The Rainbow Warrior was protesting Russian oil drilling in Arctic waters when it was taken by Russian forces. The ruling hinged upon the fact that the ship was seized without the permission of the Netherlands, where the ship is registered, thus violating Russia's international agreements.
If you believe that the fight for gay rights is one that takes place only in the other parts of the country, you may not be familiar with Lauren Brown. Lauren Brown was hired by St. Mary's Academy this year to be a full-time college counselor. Brown's employment offer was retracted by the local college after she was accused of mentioning marrying her girlfriend. While St. Mary's claims to be a diverse campus, they have put their foot down on gay marriage. The college offered Lauren Brown a full year's salary to leave the position under the condition that she not talk about it. Brown turned down the offer and instead went to the Willamette Week with the story. She hopes that by turning down the offer and bringing public attention to the school policies, she may improve the lives of others in the LGBT community. St. Mary's has responded, saying that they are bound to uphold the morals of the Catholic Church.
At today's city council meeting, the council accepted the recommendations of a task force on how to deal with the Uber and Lyft taxi services that have recently entered the Portland market. The council heard hours of testimony from taxi drivers and other local residents. The testimony was overwhelmingly opposed to the introduction of Uber and Lyft in the city of Portland.
Since being founded in 1997, our company, which operates sedan taxis, shuttles, medical, and web transportation, had been doing very well. Over the years, we have taken a keen pride in operating a well-run business with a little to no debt. We provided family wage income until April. Applied for additional permit 2 years ago and followed all the procedures the city established, including showing the demand for more taxis. After going through all the steps in good faith, I was awarded new permits 2 months before the pilot project. Part of getting these new permits was the requirement that I purchase web vehicles, which I did right away. This year, I paid 18,450 permits to 82 permits. Then along comes Uber, without going through any procedure, spelled out to the city code. They were suddenly granted unlimited ability to put an unlimited number of taxis on the road, with no real requirement for wheelchair accessible vehicles, and no requirement to the same level of insurance that branded taxi companies are required to provide. And Uber only paid $20,000 permit fee for its unlimited number of vehicles. Uber and Lyft have approximately 3,200 vehicles on the streets of Portland. If they paid the same permit fee that the branded taxi companies in Portland paid combined, they would owe the city of Portland almost $2 million. It is because Uber bullied the city into approving an opportunity that was denied me for years. You have given a $50 billion California-based company an advantage over us. Then, when the trial period began, you said Portland existing branded taxi companies could have an unlimited number of cars, too. After spending $500,000 on new wheelchair vehicles, I could not afford to buy another vehicle. Portland city leaders, I thought, had rewarded my company for providing exceptional service, but I was wrong. You have instead helped to drive my business into a state of disrepair.
My name is John Moran, and I'm a proud driver for the local rideshare company, Radio Cab. I like to use the term rideshare company because the TNCs like to use it, even though it's clearly a misnomer. There is no share in the TNC's rideshare model. It's hiring a driver and a vehicle to take you where you're going, not sharing a ride where they happen to be going. The Bureau of Transportation doesn't even believe this lie, so they have coined the term transportation network companies. In January of 2012, then-Mayor Sam Adams directed Portland City of Portland Revenue Bureau to complete a comprehensive review of the economic and working conditions of taxi drivers. The review found that the effective hourly income of Portland taxi drivers is $6.22. You're chopping up living wage jobs for part-time supplemental income jobs. If that report was done today, that income would have dropped, it would have decreased. Radio Cab isn't afraid of competition. We have been a proud staple of Portland for 75 years. Uber and Lyft are just competitions, but what you're allowing them to have is the upper hand in this competition, which is why I ask that you see what the result in the customer wait times is with just the 63% increase by saying no to TNCs.
That was testimony from today's city council hearing on the task force recommendations on taxis and transportation network companies.
Several Klamath County deputies are on leave following the investigation of Sheriff Frank Scraw for punching a suspect who was handcuffed at the time. According to early reports, the deputies requested that they be placed on paid leave because they were worried about suffering professional consequences while their supervisor is being investigated. So far, seven deputies have requested paid leave, citing a hostile work environment. Klamath County has yet to confirm the alleged incident of police brutality. However, the Justice Department has acknowledged that there is an ongoing investigation.
At today's Portland City Council meeting, the council also voted to reaffirm the city's commitment to responsible, sustainable procurement by considering the presence of conflict minerals when purchasing cellular devices and radio subscriber units. Many of the cell phones and radios produced around the world use coltan for their tiny capacitors. And most of the world's coltan originates from the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is the site of one of the world's most violent and continuous civil wars. Here's a clip from today's hearing.
Jeff Baer with Bureau of Technology Services. And just to reiterate what this is, it's a resolution and to continue to affirm our support for responsible practices where we influence the materials in the supply chain, especially when it comes to devices that have these conflict minerals in them. And just to also emphasize that this has been a very collaborative effort between the Oregon Coalition of Humanity, Bureau of Technology Services, and also Procurement Services with Christine and her team. And just to talk about some of the things that we're doing, we purchased...
Before you do that, I'm not sure that everybody at home knows what conflict minerals
are.
Very
good. Good. So the way this works is that where we buy products and where manufacturers source their materials, this in particular is about what they call 3 TGs. So it's tin, tantalum, tungsten, and gold. So those products are in a lot of electronic devices. And so where those manufacturers source that from, we want to make sure that they are in conflict-free zones. And so this, the federal requirements have provided that they have to declare where those sources of materials are. And from what I'm being told is that all of our current cellular and radio providers are in compliance with those current regulations and with this resolution.
My name is Amanda Ulrich, and I am the coordinator for the conflict mineral movement in Portland with Oregon Coalition for Humanity, and also a volunteer ambassador with Women for Women International, specifically working on their program in Eastern Congo. And so for publicly traded companies, they are required under Section 1502 of the Dodd-Frank Act to turn into the Securities and Exchange Commission if they have identified that anywhere in their supply chain they are sourcing minerals that may be from the Congo, and further if they are, where those particular minerals are coming from in their supply chain. And so there's systems already in place for those companies to audit their supply chains, and some companies do so independently and separate and apart from that requirement. And so for any company that's publicly traded, you can verify through the EDGAR system on the Securities and Exchange Commission the paperwork that they turned in.
My name is Ann Shannon, and my daughter and I are co-founders of Run for Congo Women, 1,000 Sisters, Outcry for Congo. We were instrumental in advocating for the original legislation for conflict minerals. My daughter is an author of 2 books on Congo, and both my daughter and I have traveled to DR Congo and have met extensively with victims of the violence there. And first, I do really want to thank the Procurement Office and the Technical Services Bureau for their responsiveness, and just this, it's so gratifying to live in Portland and have a government that is responsive to the deep concerns of the citizens, and that we do have an impact. And this, to me, this resolution really is an example of that. So first, I do want to note that there is a very broad base of awareness and support for policies that we take that can stop the violence in Congo. My daughter, as founder of the Run for Congo Women, we have had yearly events, and actually some more than yearly events, that were 100 to 500 women and children and men show up, and they reach out to the community asking for donations to support the victims of violence there. So there are literally tens of thousands of Portlanders who are very concerned that we do everything we can to stop this violence.
That was testimony from today's city council hearing in Portland on a measure to investigate the companies providing cell phone and communication technology to the city for their use of conflict minerals in their products. The measure passed unanimously and will go into effect in the coming year.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for news from the Boo, I suppose. That'll be followed by The Underground, KBOO's monthly program for youth and by youth at 6 o'clock. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather looks to be scattered clouds with a high of 87, moving to cloudy and 62 overnight. Today in history, in 1883... a massive eruption destroyed the volcanic island of Krakatoa, ejecting so much ash that the global temperature was lowered by 2.2 degrees Fahrenheit. Our quote of the day is from Mark Twain, who said, "It's no wonder that truth is stranger than fiction. Fiction has to make sense."
It's 5:19. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
In advice to baseball rookies, Hall of Fame star Ted Williams said, "If you don't think too good, don't think too much." This should be taken to heart by Bush League congressional leader John Boehner. The Republican Speaker of the House keeps thinking he can knock President Barack Obama out of the game by killing his signature Obamacare health program. Even though the landmark law was passed by Congress, has now been upheld twice by the Supreme Court, and is providing essential coverage for millions of previously uninsured Americans, Boehner is still swatting at it. With his Koch-funded Tea Party majority in control, the House has now swung mightily at Obamacare 67 times, and 67 times they've whiffed. Unable to win on the legislative field of play, the Speaker thought and thought, and suddenly, eureka! The way to beat Obama, he decided, is to get the judicial umpires of America's constitutional game, the Supreme Court, not just to umpire, but to join his team as partisan players. So Boehner and his lawyers have run to the courts, throwing a political tantrum over some funds that Obama spent to administer an obscure provision in the health care law. "The president threw an illegal spitter at us," they cried. "By spending that money, he usurped Congress's authority over appropriations." Wailing that this is a crass case of his constant abuse of executive power, they're pleading with the judges to do what their sorry team can't get done, despite having control of both houses of Congress. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a bunch of losers! Where were they when the Bush-Cheney regime was autocratically flouting congressional authority? Cheering them on, that's where. And yet they wonder why their public approval rating is down to only 17%. And those people who approve are probably family members, anti-Obama nuts, or corporate lobbyists.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A Colorado judge sentenced James Holmes today for his part in the 2012 mass shooting at a Colorado theater. The jury in the trial failed to reach a unanimous decision on the death penalty, which led to 2 days of testimony from victims of the shooting. At the end of that testimony, the judge sentenced James Holmes to life in prison and 3,200 years. The judge addressed complaints that the process was not fair, saying that he still had faith in the system. The judge went on to say that a juror had chosen to object to the death penalty, which requires a unanimous vote from all jurors. The judge stated that a juror had shown compassion that Holmes never showed to his own victims. Some people were angered by the sentence and went so far as to call the trial a waste of time. The judge responded by saying that the trial allowed the victims' stories to be heard and that being in prison was not going to be an easy punishment, calling prisons restrictive and harsh to live in. James Holmes's lawyer stated that they would not be appealing the decision in order to spare the families and the victims of the pain of a retrial.
The U.S. military transgender ban will end in May of next year, and a new pilot program will reportedly offer leave for any transgender soldier who wishes to undergo hormone treatment or transition-related surgery. Under current rules, gender dysphoria is grounds for disqualification from joining the U.S. military. Despite this, there may be as many as 12,000 transgender troops currently in the military. Defense Secretary Ash Carter issued a moratorium on the dismissal of transgender troops based on current policy, as well as ordering a six-month review of issues relating to transgender military members. Such issues include housing, coverage of transition-related medical treatment, uniforms, and compliance with physical fitness standards.
A report from The Guardian News reveals that only three of the remaining 116 men being held in Guantanamo prison were abducted by U.S. forces. Commonly referred to as the worst of the worst by politicians, the veracity of the claims that the men are guilty of crimes against the United States is now in doubt. The 113 men ended up in Guantanamo through a variety of avenues, often involving Afghan warlords, Pakistani security forces, and other spies. The men were taken as guilty on the word of their captors, with U.S. forces trusting that the detainees were not held simply due to vendettas or as the result of bounties being offered. The news comes on the heels of reports that the U.S. military is willfully ignoring the direct orders of their commander-in-chief, President Barack Obama, to release Shachar Amer, the last Briton to be held without charge in the prison. That claim was asserted by Shachar's lawyer, Clive Stafford Smith, in a piece written for The Guardian this past week. Smith asserts that the fact that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General William Dempsey, has not acted on his direct order from the president constitutes a crisis of democracy and should be viewed as a threat to the rule of law in this country.
The global market crash that began in China and spread across the world this week has far-reaching consequences, especially when it comes to economies based on commodities like oil and minerals. In Chile, the world's largest copper producer, the commodities crash could further exacerbate already contentious labor disputes in the mining sector. Joshua Tucker has more from Santiago.
The Chilean economy runs on copper. It makes up 60% of the country's exports, and Codelco, the state-run mining company, is the Chilean government's biggest source of income, helping pay for everything from schools to healthcare. In 2014, China was the world's largest single purchaser of copper, buying 40% of the international market share. When Chinese stock markets took a dive on Monday, it set off a chain reaction. $5 billion in mining capital disappeared over the course of a few hours. Before global markets cast an economic shadow over Chile, Codelco was already in the midst of volatile labor negotiations, with the union representing 70% of its contract workers, the Confederación de Trabajadores de Cobre, or CTC. On July 20th, the CTC began a national strike that affected production at seven Codelco mines, including Chuquicamata, the world's biggest open-pit copper mine by excavated volume. Striking miners completely took over two Codelco open-pit mines, barricading the entrances of the El Salvador mine and later the Hales mine. Before dawn on July 24th, police special forces attacked the CTC's flaming barricades at the entrance of the El Salvador mine. CTC spokesman Miguel Santana describes what happened.
A unit trained in urban warfare arrived at the El Salvador mine to corral the workers, and when they saw they were outnumbered, they began to fire indiscriminately. The workers had a bulldozer there that they were using to build barricades along the road with dirt. The mine is in the desert, so they couldn't make barricades with things like tree trunks. The only way is to dump loads of dirt and burn tires to block the road. The bulldozers are armored to protect workers from falling rocks inside the mine. When you look at the photos of the bulldozers, you can see they were shooting directly at the workers. The bullets were aimed not at their legs, but at their heads, at the workers' torsos. You can tell from the height of the bullet marks left on the bulldozer. It was a shoot-to-kill operation.
According to the police report, special forces fired at least 33 shots, killing one striking worker named Nelson Kichiwau Lopez, and injuring several more. The 45,000 members of the CTC continued their strike for a total of 22 days before voting to conditionally suspend the strike and enter negotiations with Codelco. Those talks began last week. Codelco Vice President for Production and Cost, José Robles, spoke for the company outside the negotiations.
What we want to do with all the incentive mechanisms associated with worker pay is peg them to productivity. This is what we've put forth as central to our disposition to continue facilitating this dialogue and stay on as a facilitator between the contracting companies and their workers.
Robles estimates the strike has cost Codelco around $80 million, $60 million in lost production, and $20 million in damages to equipment and facilities. Falling copper prices will not only make it hard for the company to quickly recover, but could also affect the country's longer-term budget plans. The labor disputes and low copper prices round out a challenging season for mining in Chile. A deputy mining minister was jailed and is now under house arrest, awaiting trial on bribery and money laundering charges after allegedly taking funds from private mining companies. A member of the president's cabinet resigned after revealing mining companies had given him honorariums. And in March, in the mining industry-dominated city of Antofagasta, a historic crowd of more than 10,000 people protested the environmental contamination caused by mining. Regional Mining Minister Reynaldo Leyva recently responded to ongoing environmental protests on the Atacama area's Mara Radio.
There are a group of people that oppose these mining projects no matter what, even though they benefit our region. And what they are saying is they want to eat cake, but they don't want to break any eggs.
As representatives of the CTC and Codelco met in Santiago last week, raised voices could be heard coming from inside their closed-door negotiations. The outcome of the talks is uncertain, but the economic signs are not promising. Falling oil prices have already led to currency devaluations in countries dependent on oil exports, which could hint at what's on the horizon for Chile. As Chinese markets fell Monday, the Chilean peso hit its second lowest point in history against the U.S. dollar. And if copper prices continue to fall, the economic shockwaves in Chile will likely travel beyond the bottom lines of mine owners and the paychecks of mine workers. Joshua Tucker, FSRN, Santiago.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The United Auto Workers and Deere & Company have opened negotiations on their next labor contract. The UAW represents 11,200 workers at Deere in 11 UAW locals. UAW President Dennis Williams says the key to a good contract is one in which UAW members prosper, John Deere prospers, and customers prosper with our products. The UAW and Deere will negotiate a master agreement covering Deere operations in Illinois, Iowa, Kansas, Atlanta, and Denver. As approximately 39,000 workers continue efforts to reach a fair new labor contract at Verizon while resisting concessions, one of the people on the bargaining team for the unions says continual wage and benefits erosion for U.S. workers is a huge problem. IBEW's Miles Calvi told Workers Independent News that the incredible wage erosion is unsustainable if the American middle class is to survive.
The incredible erosion of wages that's taken over where everything is going to be just slowly decreased. People live in houses. People aren't going to be able to afford houses anymore. Rents are going through the roof. Well, after a while, people aren't going to be able to afford that because they just can't the way the trend is going right now. Nobody's kept up with inflation. I just read something the other day. 33 years since wages have been at the same level as inflation. 33 years.
Air gas workers, including drivers, plant operators, and fillers in Islandia, New York, will become Teamsters. The workers voted to join Teamsters Local 282. Keith Gleason, director of the Teamsters Tank Haul Division, says nationally the air gas company has recently changed its attitude toward hardworking employees. He says this vote for a union there is what happens when employers disrespect their employees. The Teamsters represent 40 other bargaining units at Airgas. The company is headquartered in Radnor, Pennsylvania, and employs more than 16,000 workers. A New York coalition of nail salon workers is supporting calls for required wage bonds in the industry. Coalition says bonds are needed to cover wage theft claims that arise because nail salons have a history of closing up shop when a wage theft case is brought, claiming inability to pay. Governor Andrew Cuomo wants a bond requirement. Julie Kelly, general manager and vice president of Workers United New York, New Jersey Regional Joint Board, says the bond requirement is an enormous step forward in holding employers accountable.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays, noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com. Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, as well as rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This week, the country of Israel decided to bar 1,200 asylum seekers of African descent from living in Tel Aviv and nearby city Eilat. The people have been in Israeli detention centers for as long as 18 months. They had been living in the city before being detained, and now that the government has banned them from returning to their homes, many of them are worried about not having anywhere to sleep. The Ministry of Interior offered no explanation for the decision. It is the latest move to make life intolerable in order to coerce African refugees to leave Israel.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, August 26, 2015. Human rights group condemned death sentence and Israeli soldiers demolished Palestinian structures during invasions targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers demolished on Wednesday at dawn several commercial and residential structures in Al-Izariya town, east of occupied East Jerusalem, after surrounding the town and invading it. The demolished structures were removed for the construction of a section of the annexation wall in the area, local sources reported. According to witnesses, undercover units, police officers and personnel of the civil administration office, run by the army in the occupied West Bank, carried out the destruction of the Palestinian properties. The demolished buildings are a mobile home and seven trade structures used for selling furniture, fruits and vegetables, a car wash facility, and a store for selling silverware. In other news, Israeli forces kidnapped on Wednesday 32 Palestinian citizens in several cities and villages across the occupied West Bank. Home searches and kidnappings were reported in the districts of Hebron and Bethlehem, southern West Bank, in addition to the central West Bank district of Ramallah and Nablus in the north and Jericho. In other news, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, PCHR, reiterated its calls for the abolition of death penalty in the PA-controlled areas. The call came after the Permanent Military Court in Gaza City, acting as a court of first instance, sentenced a man from Gaza City to death by firing squad after convicting him of collaborating with a foreign hostile entity. The total number of death sentences issued by the PA since 1994 has risen to 161, of which 133 has been issued in the Gaza Strip and 28 in the West Bank. Among those issued in the Gaza Strip, 76 have been issued since Hamas took over the Gaza Strip in 2007. The Palestinian Authority also executed 32 death sentences, of which 30 have been executed in the Gaza Strip and 2 in the West Bank. Among those executed in the Gaza Strip, 19 have been executed since 2007 without ratification by the Palestinian president in violation of the law. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, August 26, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghaz Bamura.
A report posted on Politico this week outlines the fact that algorithms used by search engines can be used without detection to influence outcomes of elections. The report found that when people use search engines, they rarely look beyond the past six top results, a technique known as the search engine manipulation effect, which is impossible to detect since it occurs across large numbers of search engine users, is viewed as the most likely technique whereby manipulation would occur. Search engine manipulation involves tailoring search results to individual users, a technique that is becoming more common as advertisers seek to target consumers. While the authors do not make any specific accusations of manipulation, they do highlight the fact that the level of sophistication of the typical search engine user can be used to influence the opinions of voters. The 2014 election in India is examined in detail, with search results seeming to predict the winner, Narendra Modi. Whether this represents an instance of manipulation is not specified, although the author suggests that it does serve as a real-world example of the effects of search engine results on political choices. Highlighting the fact that current U.S. presidential campaigns have hired top executives of tech companies, the authors discuss at least three scenarios whereby search engine manipulation can occur: direct manipulation of results, rogue employees inserting malicious code, or search algorithms serving one candidate over another due to coding weaknesses. But no evidence suggests that this has ever happened. The author suggests that the best thing that search engine users can do to protect themselves from being indirectly manipulated is to seek out multiple sources of information, to remain critical of any information they receive while making decisions related to political choices, and turn on incognito mode in the Chrome browser to anonymize activity.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Terrell Lowry, Jimmy Tardy, and Joe. Our producer is Galen Sanford. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you would like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard about on the news tonight, here are their numbers, so grab something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River at 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Joanne Hardesty hosts Voices from the Edge, progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective. At 9, hear Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, host Sarika Mehta speaks with Pamaz Furutan, author of the debut novel The Girl from the Garden, the complex, tragic history of a wealthy family of Persian Jews in the 20th century Iran. And at 11:30, the film show features news and interviews about the independent film scene in Portland. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
On Saturday, August 29th, from 2 p.m. until 5 p.m., the revolutionary music and spirit of Miss Nina Simone will be celebrated by three generations of Grassroots News on KBOO Community Radio.
I put a spell on you. Cause you're mine.
Let us put a spell on you Saturday, August 29th from 2 p.m. until 5 p.m. with the music and revolutionary life of Miss Nina Simone, right here on 90.7 FM, KBOO.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
A vigil is taking place in Beaverton right now, targeting Senator Ron Wyden. The participants are asking for Wyden's support for the deal with Iran. Senator Wyden is still on the fence about whether to support the deal. There are over 200 such vigils taking place nationwide today, Wednesday, August 26th. Today in Portland, a vigil took place at noon at Senator Ron Wyden's office at 911 Northeast 11th Street. And in Beaverton, a vigil began at 5 p.m. at Southwest 5th and Hall across from the Beaverton Library. Both vigils call on Ron Wyden to support the deal with Iran. Lisa Stiller is one of the organizers, and she joins us now live from the vigil. Lisa, what's the scene right now in front of the Beaverton Library?
We've got about 50 to 60 people. They have a table where people are signing petitions. They're lining each side of the street. We're getting a lot of positive response from people passing by. It's very laid back, but it's wonderful how many people showed up.
And what are you hoping to accomplish with this vigil?
Well, one of the things that we did was we collected, I think there are about 3,000 signatures on Wyden's petition. A lot of signatures asking Wyden, and we're going to be also asking Bamanichi to support the deal with Iran, because they're both sitting on the fence right now, and we feel that it's extremely important to be proactive here and prevent war before we even start thinking about it. And this deal, no, it's not perfect, but it puts in place a